States of America versus Antonio Uribe Quintero.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Hendricks. Here today to talk about a sentencing that increasingly is common, at least within the Northern District, and that is to describe a sentencing where you have a sentencing for an underlying conviction, and for today's purposes, I'm going to refer to that as the conviction sentence, and then it's immediately followed by a supervised release revocation hearing, in which case then we're, I'm going to refer to revocation sentence. I'm going to talk about, or suggest that we talk about two things. One, the question of aggregation, because I think that's going to come up later or perhaps sooner. And second, our contention about what the record unequivocally illustrates that was in the district court's mind and actually guiding what the court did. So to set the stage, what happened here is that Mr. Uribe was sentenced to 100 months for an illegal reentry, and as soon as that sentence was imposed, the district court and the parties immediately rolled into the revocation. During both proceedings, the court made reference to either the previous proceeding or the subsequent proceeding. That's a little bit atypical, I would say. Certainly it's not my experience that a court will make those type of references. It may have them in its mind, of course.
But you could do these together. I did revocations and sentences together within the same hearing and just did them all as one hearing. There's no rule that you have to adjourn one hearing and then start another, is there?
I'm not aware of a rule, Judge Elrod, and that's interesting because I've not ever seen that practice, and so that's new to me.
You might talk to your friends in the valley.
As a matter of fact, I will, but one of the concerns that would immediately jump out in my mind, at least, is whether or not the sentencing court is making clear that its considerations of the factors that are applicable for the what I'm going to again refer to as the conviction sentence are separate and apart from its considerations of the revocation sentence. And in fact, that's
but
one.
But does it have to be?
Oh, I think it does.
Tell me why.
Because the statutory scheme set out by the Congress excludes punishment considerations for the revocation sentence, and the reason for that, of course, is the notion that a sentence of imprisonment that's imposed in a revocation goes to breach of trust, basically for not following the promises or breaking the promises, if you will, of the release conditions, whereas punishment that is imposed on a conviction obviously goes to the underlying criminal conduct. And the statutory scheme is quite explicit, and this court in Miller recognized that you don't consider punishment for the underlying conviction in a revocation proceeding. And so I'm certainly not going to stand here today and talk about practices of which I'm not familiar, say like what you've just described, but I will go so far as to say that if a court's going to do that, it needs to make sure it does it correctly. And that's exactly why I think we're here today, because it wasn't done correctly.
Well, it seems that rather than, this certainly is not a case where the court would say that I'm giving punishment in the one inappropriately. This court was saying that I would have given more in the underlying conviction proceeding had I not known that I was going to have this other hearing in a few minutes.
Well, I think what the court actually said, let me take issue there if I can, because I think
sure.
Your language is a little bit broad. What the court said was that because I'm going to sentence in the second proceeding consecutively to the first, I may have, and the word in fact that it used was probably, would have sentenced him to a higher term. So I don't think this court can rely with any degree of certainty on the proposition that the district court would have done this.
Have to be certain. We just have to decide whether it infringes upon the justice system and hurts the integrity of the court to let this stand. And if they probably were going to give a higher sentence in the other case, it may not impinge upon the integrity of the court. That would be the argument.
That's certainly not my position, because you've gone directly to the fourth prong of the plain error analysis, and I would, with respect, suggest that we stop at three first before we would get
to four.
Well,
I'm spotting you three.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
That whole argument spots you three to get you to four.
Well, I just wanted to clarify, but I do appreciate that. Then, with regard to the fourth prong, what I would simply say is we're talking about a 10-month gap or difference here, and I don't think that's unsubstantial.
But if they say the 10-month gap could be justified because they would have given a higher sentence on the other case, then it's not of such a big deal that we should use our power, our discretionary power that we should use sparingly to correct.
I disagree, again, with respect. First of all, what comes to mind, excuse me, is that the problem with the justification for the 10 months is that it's relying on what happened in the earlier proceeding. Now, that was appealed. The government didn't cross appeal, suggesting anything was wrong. But that's where the play was, if you will. What's happening now is that in an attempt to satisfy this court that the particular revocation sentence is okay, we're talking about reference to something that the government itself chose not to disturb below. The fact of the matter is, this court said, it said specifically, I think a sentence within the guideline range, comma, a 24-month sentence in this case, because that's what it mistakenly thought the guideline range was appropriate. I think that's actually rather explicit, saying I'm comfortable with the notion of the guideline sentence. Now,
okay. What if he would have said, I think the statutory maximum is okay? He'd have said that instead, which is the same 24 months.
It is.
Would you have a much harder case if he'd have said, I think the statutory max is just fine for me?
I think that under those circumstances, I'd have a harder time.
Would you lose on plain error?
I wouldn't profess to speak for the panel, but I would have a harder case. But the court said, and I'm going to rely on what the court said, I think a guideline sentence is appropriate. And I think that...
But it'd be the same exact sentence. It would just be a different justification.
Well, but all I have to go on, of course, is because I certainly don't want to get into the position where I'm trying to go inside the district court's mind. I mean, it's fun to do those things, but I can't sit here with any sense of integrity and tell you what the judge was thinking.
Right.
Yes. The short of it is, what I'm going on is what the judge said, and of course. I suppose if there were concerns about what I'm going to refer to as the play, there was no play in the revocation because 24 months was the statutory maximum as well. I suppose that proceeding could have gone first, and then the district court, if it had been thinking in terms of aggregation, it didn't explicitly say it was thinking in terms of an aggregated sentence, then it would certainly have been able to play more with the conviction sentence. But that's not the way that it chose to do business, and I'm certainly not going to second guess how it's choosing to do business.
I do have one more question about the aggregation before we completely leave that. It's my fault we've left that, but I have one more question. You cited a case that says you shouldn't consider the one for the other, what's said at one hearing versus another. I don't really, it's an unpublished case, and I don't find that case actually says you can't consider. In fact, the last paragraph of the analysis of that says, well, and the court did consider it, so... And the defendant argued in the exact opposite of what you're arguing and said you should consider it. So I don't think that case supports your position.
And here's what I would like to do. I'm in an awkward position today because I'm pinch hitting. Yes, the defender did cite that, and I do represent the defender and my colleague who did this briefing, but I did not do the briefing. We had 5 oral arguments scheduled for this period, and I was asked to come down and help, and I'm pleased for the opportunity.
And you've done a fabulous job.
Well, thank you. It doesn't feel as fabulous
so you,
right
you weren't
now.
You weren't the lawyer that represented him in court?
No.
And you weren't the lawyer that wrote the brief?
No.
So you're our third choice?
I am the bottom of the barrel. And in fact, when they were looking at the schedule saying who can go down, you know, it was like, I guess we'll send Beard. So there we are. So where I'm going with this is that I'm not in a position to speak much other than to say that from talking with Mr. Page, my colleague, what he, I know at least in part, was citing the case for was also the proposition, because the case does talk about that breach of trust versus punishment.
Okay.
And
that,
I think that is.
Yeah, that case would not preclude us from aggregating the comments.
I'll certainly defer, of course,
okay.
to your reading, because I must. I do want to suggest, though, that we're not prepared to concede at all, though, speaking about aggregation. This is what the district court had in mind, because I don't think a fair reading of this record suggests that. And I certainly, as I pointed out earlier, the court's use of the word probably to describe what it might have done, that's certainly quite, I think, speculative by definition. And we also don't know, even if the court were to have had it in its mind, this notion of aggregation, we don't know how far it might have increased. We don't know that it would have necessarily made up the 10-month difference, had any of the parties, certainly our trial attorney, but also the other parties, recognized that the criminal history category.
You're not encouraged by the fact that the defendant had a pretty bad record with some serious offenses, and he's going back before Judge McBride. You're not encouraged, and you put those with what he said, and it is very doubtful if this error harmed the defendant. That's the case, isn't it? That's this lawsuit. Isn't it this appeal?
That we're discouraged.
Doesn't this appeal, it's plain error.
Yes.
So doesn't it depend entirely on what we can tell from this record would be the harm or the prejudice if he's not resentenced?
Yeah, yes, I mean, it's certainly plain error.
That's this problem.
But I think, to address some of the remarks that you had made, we're certainly not, resentencing is always an interesting experience. And I would certainly concede that it would be, and it is often interesting to contemplate resentencing in certain district courts. In this particular case, the district court had indicated explicitly that it thought a guideline sentence was appropriate. I would feel reasonably confident, subject to one thing, and I'll share that momentarily, reasonably confident that were I representing the individual at resentencing, it would be very comfortable talking to the district court and saying to the district court, you spoke to the propriety of a guideline sentence before, and we're here to speak to the propriety of a guideline sentence on remand. The one possible exception being, and I concede it because I must in candor, I'm assuming for purposes of our discussion that my client might not have been in trouble at the BOP, and then under a Pepper analysis, any type of consideration of discipline problems when he got back. So assuming that everything else stays equal, this is one of the times when I would actually feel comfortable. But certainly in front of the district court, making the arguments that we've made now and explaining to the district court, this is what you said before, let's go with it.
You're not going to send Mr. Page?
I'm sorry?
You're not going to make Mr. Page go back if you win?
I'm not sure how that will break out, but at this point it may be mine, so you know, be careful what you ask for. You may get it, I suppose. But yes, it is plain error, and you're absolutely correct, Judge. We're looking at the record, but we have language here that I think is quite supportive of us. The use of the word probably, the use of the word consecutive to explain why the initial conviction sentence was subject to some, if not trepidation, some questioning in the district court's mind. Certainly the lack of evidence to suggest that it would have necessarily gone down in a 10-month way. Even if it went down 4 months or 5 months, that's still a benefit to us. And, of course, that immediately propels us back, I think, to the fourth prong.
Can in this case, are we looking at two different records? I mean, he got sentenced the first time for 100 months, and then he got to 24 months. And we're sort of combining the two records to try to figure out what the judge intended to do. Is that okay to go look at the record of another case to figure out what he meant to do in this case?
As a general proposition, no, but I believe that Mr. Hendricks had supplemented this record and it went unopposed, and that's fine. The operative language that we're focused on is what happened in the revocation sentence, but I'm not here trying to play, whack-a-mole or anything like that with the court. I mean, the judge was actually making reference, and I think as a courtesy, it would make sense for us all to be able to look at what he was saying in the first sentencing that had just taken place moments before. And in any event, that is the state of this record. Perhaps not all records. There was no motion by the government, and certainly not by us, to tie the appeals together. The first appeal on the underlying conviction sentence has already gone up, and there was no decision or effort by the government to try to appeal that or to tie these together. We're left on plain error with this record, and I think that this record supports our position.
Well, I'm troubled by a statement that was made in the actual revocation hearing, and it's a statement that was made by defense counsel, where the defense counsel says the guidelines recommend a sentence on the supervised release violation for 18 to 24 months. Mm-hmm. He didn't say probation says, or according to what you say, or assuming that it's 18 to 24, we asked for the 18. He made a pronouncement that 18 to 24 months is the right range. Mm-hmm. Isn't that a problem? Because if the defense lawyer actually led the court into believing that 18 to 24 months was the correct range. Of course, he's not the only one there leading the court. It's the probation and the government and everybody. Right. But if he's participating in that, that seems to be problematic for you as well, because it's not just, oh, we learn later. It's that we affirmatively said it was 18 to 24 months. And maybe that should count against you on prong four. Just as I think Judge Jones has an opinion where something that the defense lawyer said counted against on prong four, even if it couldn't be used for the actual, mm-hmm. you know which case I'm talking about.
May I respond
yes.
briefly, certainly? Well, without a doubt, that I mean, the record speaks for itself. That's what the trial counsel said. I don't think it's, I don't think there was an attempt to misinform the court. I mean, it's a mistake. They all made a mistake. Obviously, we bear the greater burden, and we're paying the greater price for it.
But do you waive this or forfeit it in some way because of that?
Well, I mean, the posture of the case now, I mean, obviously that we're here on plain error. I mean, he made a mistake. He
didn't
see it.
But can you even be here on plain error?
I think so.
If with an affirmative statement to the contrary.
Yes, I think so, because and I think if the court were determined to the contrary, I think it sends an interesting signal as far as how to conduct sentencing, because obviously in the first place, we all want to be correct. All litigants and the litigators want to be correct when we're talking to the court. But if there's a question now about, well, if I say something and I'm incorrect in what I'm saying, that it may come back to bite us on appeal, then it's just going to incur saying as little possible, and I don't think that necessarily does anyone any favors.
Or it maybe encourages us to be more precise, and not we might have fewer of these plain. You know, this is very difficult for the district courts to think that they are doing everything correctly, and then have this be the most common way that you get appealed in this circuit is in a sentencing hearing. You know,
I can promise you that as a result of this case being here on plain error, that there has already been due attention and, what's the way to say this, a learning opportunity and a reminder to the district, to our district, our trial counsel about the uphill sledding we have here. And I'm sure if he listens to the oral argument that lesson will already be reinforced.
How was the error caught? Who, was this after the fact, somebody reviewed the record, or how did we?
Oh, I don't know for sure, Judge Prado, but I feel quite sure Mr. Page, the appellate counsel, caught it. That's my understanding. I don't know for sure, and if I've misspoken, I'll get back with you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Hendricks?
May it please the court. Wes Hendricks on behalf of the United States. The defendant today would require certainty in the record for this court to affirm, but this court's case law nor Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 52 require such a burden. And I'll start with the question of aggregation, which my colleague today focuses heavily on. First point I'd like to make is that, ironically, the defendant asked the district court in this case to consider the separate sentences during the aggregated sentencing process. Reentry sentencing came first. And during that process, the defense counsel asked for the low end of the guideline range, quote, especially given that this case will be preceded by the revocation case. And then immediately following that, during the revocation hearing, the defendant asked for a 24-month sentence, but asked that it be run concurrently in part with the sentence imposed during the reentry offense. So the defendant asked the court here to consider one when considering the other. The record has been supplemented with the other with the reentry offense sentencing hearing, and it's perfectly appropriate for this court to consider the court statements during the reentry during this appeal. Related to the aggregation point, defense counsel also implies that, well, maybe in doing so, the court might have erred, because we know under Miller that the court can't consider punishment, 3553A2, during a revocation. I would call the court's attention to the end of the revocation sentencing record, where the court said that it was basing the sentence and found the revocation sentence to be appropriate and necessary under the 3553A factors to the extent applicable. And we know what the court is doing there, because the Miller issue has come up often. And what the court is doing there is carving out from 3553A, A2, the thing that he's not supposed to consider. This court's case law establishes that when the effect of even a clear error is uncertain, the defendant simply can't meet his burden. Here, we have a statutory maximum sentence based on criminal history and recidivism that's stacked with an upward variance sentence that the court made clear would be even longer but for the revocation sentence. Now, under those circumstances,
It probably would.
Well,
he doesn't say I would definitely. He says probably.
During the reentry offense, he speaks with more confidence. During the revocation offense, he says probably. And that goes back exactly to the burden of proof. It's the defendant's burden to show a reasonable probability that but for this error, the sentence would have been lower. If anything, it's the opposite here. The record establishes probably that there would not be any change, that if this were remanded, the district court is going to impose the same 24 months, and we're going to have a stacked 124-month sentence.
Well, that's true, and it may be judicial realism that you're giving us, but that's true in many of these cases, that the court is absolutely free to impose the same sentence as long as they do it the right way. So that shouldn't change, unless they've actually said that they would have given that sentence for another reason.
Well, I agree that they're absolutely free to impose whatever sentence they like within the bounds of the law, of course. The point I was trying to make was that we do have to look at what the record says. And the record here is not only devoid of what the court would do should this court remand, which this court has affirmed, by the way, when the record is devoid, as in Boykin, in the same posture, because the defendant can't meet his burden. So the defendant's burden here today. But we have much more than a devoid record. Four considerations really undermine the defendant's and preclude the defendant's ability to meet his burden. First, the interrelation of these sentences. We know that even when the court believed that the policy statement range was higher, it still varied upward to 100 months and imposed a statutory maximum sentence for revocation. That reentry sentence is an upward variance. The revocation sentence is a statutory maximum. And finally, we have the court's comments about its particular frustration with this defendant. This defendant's criminal history includes an aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, two prior deportations, two prior illegal reentries, and the sentence and the court's comment shows that this district court really wanted to send a message to this defendant, and it did so.
Do we know if this defendant was before this judge on the first case?
We do know that, Judge Prado, and the answer is no. The initial illegal reentry was in the Southern District of Texas, the Brownsville Division. My colleague today grasps this portion of the revocation transcript where the court says, "I think a sentence within the guideline range, a 24-month sentence," and that's where it stops, to argue that, oh, well, that there we have something where the court is tying this to the incorrect policy statement range.
That's the best thing in the case for them.
That's their best fact. That is absolutely their best fact. And my response to that, in addition to what I've already said, is that...
Well, other 10 months higher than the other range is also their co-equal best facts. That it's 10 months higher
than the other range.
Fair enough.
It's a 10-month gap. It's a 10-month gap. And to that, I would say larger increases have been affirmed. In Davis, there was a 12-month difference.
Can you keep going with the guidelines?
Absolutely, absolutely. In response to that, I would say, quite understandably, he's asking this court to view the revocation sentence in isolation and not look at the bigger picture. I've spoken about that bigger picture. More importantly, the court interrupts itself right at that point. I think a sentence within the guideline range, a 24-month sentence, stop, full stop. And then he goes on the side about supervised release and is it going to run concurrent with the other one? And then he never really finishes that thought. When he concludes the sentencing, he then grasps the 3553A factors to the extent applicable. And I would say at most that snippet in the record is indicating, is the judge noting that this sentence happens to be within the range. It's a statutory maximum sentence. It also happens to be the top of the incorrect range. The court didn't say that the sentence needed to be within any policy statement range, whatever that was. And this court, I know it's a fine point, but this court has hinged cases on that point.
But did he check statement of reasons, guideline range, or did he check outside of advisory or statutory? Which block did he check in the statement of reasons?
There is no statement of reasons for the revocation sentence.
Okay, there's no statement of reasons, so we don't have anything to help us on there.
I immediately looked in hopes, but there was not one, I can't seek shelter there. But relatedly, I do call the court's attention to its opinion in Lee, where it made this exact point. In Lee, the court said, I'm going to impose a mid-range sentence. And of course, defense counsel in that case held on to that and said, look, we have a sentence within the incorrect range, and the court said it's a mid-range sentence. And this court affirmed nonetheless, noting, quote, the district court may have found that the appropriate sentence happened to fall in the middle of that calculated range, but it is not certain that it found the sentence appropriate because it was mid-range. And when you look at the constellation of facts here and the record here, the same is true. But not only does the record support affirmance in this case, case law does as well. Boykin involved the exact same error, and this court affirmed on facts less strong for the government. There just was nothing in the record about what the court really would do or wanted to do should the court reverse. And nonetheless, this court affirmed because it's the defendant's burden.
Do you believe that we should review for plain error, or do you believe that the error has been forfeited in some way such that it's unreviewable?
That is a very interesting question, Judge. I think in fairness to the district court, this court would be well within its power and would be reasonable in saying that any error is either invited or waived. When you have not only everyone just being silent, but you have defense counsel standing up and affirmatively representing what the policy statement range is here.
But the parade of horribles that would result if we were to say that, then the defense lawyers would constantly have to be cabining their comments and at the hearings.
So maybe
it's better to decide the case on plain error from your perspective?
Absolutely. Yeah, it could easily encourage silence from defense counsel when talking about the range. There are many things to consider should this court go down that path. The instinct, I think, is a fair one because these are the most common criminal appeals from my perspective anyway. I see sentencing appeals more than anything else. We're here often on plain error review, and we ultimately end up in a guessing game and speculation. And speculation and guessing simply cannot meet the defendant's burden. That's pointed out in Boykin, in Davis, in Dixon, in Lee. And it should be the same here. Plain error serves very important institutional interests, encouraging timely objections, reducing wasteful reversals, and respecting the finality of judgments. Those interests are well in play here. Nothing in the record and nothing in the case law outweighs those important interests. And unless this court has further questions, the government would be glad to see the remainder of its time. Thank you very much.
I certainly agree with Mr. Hendricks with regard to the disdain for speculation and guessing. But I would like to make sure that everyone understands we're not hiding a ball or anything else. We are appealing the case that came to us, and we're looking at explicit language. Probably means probably. Consecutive means consecutive. Do we have stronger facts, as Judge Elrod pointed out, than others? Of course. But we're not trying to divine what the district court was thinking. We're actually looking at what the district court said It's rather refreshing sometimes to be able to stand and tell you that. So I'm somewhat struck by the irony here, because in fact, the government's saying, look at the big picture. And we're saying, look at the appeal. We didn't oppose the supplementation of the record with the earlier sentencing. We're not attempting to cabin the appeal, this court's view. We're simply saying, look at what the district court said. The I didn't hear from the government, nor had I mentioned initially the Mudakunya opinion. We don't think the court hangs its hat on Davis if it gets this far. We think Mudakunya shows not only the third, or established the third and fourth prong, we're talking about 10 months here. nor are we saying that we should require certainty or that the or that we're making undue suggestions. Again, we're tying it to the language here. I think a fair reading of what the district court was doing was looking at the consecutive nature of the sentence. The trial attorney did make some requests of the court, but I think it would be disingenuous to suggest, and I'm not saying Mr. Hendricks is suggesting that there was any type of deceit or anything like that. He made a mistake. He didn't get the range correct, and he was saying, I would like a 111-month sentence. And he explained his rationale for that. He was saying, take the high point here, take the high point there. Now, the reason he probably did that, probably, is because in that particular court, the high end is a fairly standard place that you'll see defendants sentenced. And so he was saying, if you add the two high point figures, you can then run part of the sentence concurrently. So I do want to stand in defense of the trial attorney. He was attempting to explain and argue for the best sentence he could for this individual, consistent with what he knows the trial practice to be there. I don't think he was intentionally urging or injecting any type of error. I don't think any of the people were. This is just one that got by, and that's what it was. I do appreciate Mr. Hendricks's comment about the 3553A factors to the extent applicable. I don't know what the district court meant. It's not me that's suggesting what the district court meant. Mr. Hendricks has said, well, what we know this means. I don't know exactly what it means. I do know this. This particular district court spends quite a bit of time, and did here today, explaining some of its calculus. So with respect, I'm simply not prepared to go that far. If the panel has no further questions, I'll cede the balance of my time as well. Thank you very much.
Mr. Hendricks.